The yeshiva crisis in New York is still very real, although it's been overshadowed by the war in Gaza. Yeshivas are still in grave danger of being forced to radically change their curriculum. Last week, a critical hearing took place, and here now to discuss all of that is renowned attorney Avi Schick, who is representing the yeshivas. Avi is a good friend of the program. He's a masterful attorney with an illustrious track record representing the Frum community for many years. Avi, I always appreciate your wisdom and clarity, and it is great to have you here.
Thank you for having me on.
Our absolute privilege. Let's dive in here. Last year, you had a big win in the state Supreme Court. And last week, from what I understand, the state filed an appeal. And last week, the hearing was on that appeal. And they're essentially trying to strike down that Supreme Court ruling. Is that correct?
That's right. Just about a year ago, the state Supreme Court ruled in a lawsuit that we brought, that the yeshiva community brought, that the regulations that the state education department had enacted that were, you know, opposed by all corners of Klal Yisrael and were enacted over that opposition, the court ruled that important parts of those regulations exceeded SED's authority, were contrary to the law, contrary to the education law, and therefore struck them down. The core of the state Supreme Court's ruling last year was that the education law, the compulsory education law, is directed at parents. It says this is the education a child should get. It's not a regulation that puts private schools, religious schools, under the thumb of the state education department. And therefore, it struck down provisions that would have authorized state and local school districts to close yeshivas that they thought were not precisely, you know, equivalent in the manner that they interpret it, that would force parents to unenroll children in the yeshiva of their choice and move them somewhere else. So it was really important in terms of just, you know, diminishing the state's coercive power to put yeshivas out of business, to stop services, to separate, you know, children from the moysid that the parents had chosen for them. State Supreme Court said, you, state education department, cannot do that under the law. The state appealed. And last Thursday, as you said, we had an oral argument in Albany at the appellate division, it's called, the Intermediate Appellate Court. It's a panel of five judges. And last week, last Thursday, we had argument on the state's appeal.
Okay. And just so I get understand, before we get to last week's hearing and last week's appeal hearing in the appellate court, I'm learning how all this is done, because I know there's a lot of levels here. It's a little confusing. But last year's ruling, I should say, in the Supreme Court, which you just broke down, it almost sounds like a technicality in a way, in the sense that they're not striking down the entire law. They're not saying that you have no right to determine secular studies equivalency guidelines. It's more like shifting it. It's not on the yeshiva, it's on the parents. Therefore, they have no right to shut down the yeshiva. Now, I can understand how that's a big blow, because I guess it makes it almost impossible. It's not merely a technicality. Can you just explain that?
Sure. Absolutely. So the court ruling was not a technicality last year. It was not. It went to the core of the regulations and the core of what the state education department was trying to do. And it importantly, you know, clarified, you know, what the law, what the education law allows and what it doesn't allow. It's true that it didn't, you know, it didn't tell the state education department that it cannot, you know, it cannot assess equivalency. Although even there, it's important to note that what the state Supreme Court said was, you know, we, meaning the yeshiva community, can come back and bring an as-applied challenge, right? We did a facial challenge. What we said is, you know, we filed the lawsuit, you know, soon after the state put it into effect. And we said that, you know, just as a matter of law, it's illegal. It exceeds SED's authority. What the state Supreme Court said is, on certain aspects of it, like how they assess a yeshiva, what they determine is necessary for equivalence, there you can come back, you know, as applied. When they try to apply it to a particular yeshiva or to a group of yeshivas, they can come back. You can come back and argue to the court, explain to the court why what they're doing is specifically what they're doing and how they're interpreting it is illegal. But, you know, it didn't say that they don't have the right to you know, big picture, to assess equivalence. What they did say is that while you can assess equivalence, you can't then take your assessments and unilaterally use it to cut off services, to unenrolled students to close down a school. And I think that, so that was a very, very important point. And I said it was a matter of law. In other words, it's not that if you do it differently, if you go back and use different words. You know, the court said the law does not provide for this, and that's important. Regulations, right, state agencies only have the authority that the legislature has given them. So it wasn't like, oh, go use different magic words or put it through a different process. It said you can't do it. And so that was important. It was important enough for the state to appeal, right, and say, no, we do need this right. We want that right. Now, again, we can go into what the state said in its appeal, and it's, you know, very disingenuous in the way they, you know, went about it. But that explains the ruling that came down last March and what the state did with that ruling, which is to tell the appellate division, ask the appellate division to set that aside.
Right. Okay. And I definitely want to get into what the appeal is about, and you call it disingenuous. So I very, very much want to hear about that. I have one, I think, final question about the background before we jump into that, which is let's say the state had not, obviously, like you say, the state saw this as a huge blow and a huge loss, and it was a big win for the yeshivas. If the state had not appealed last March's ruling, we would have been happy on our end. We would have kept that ruling intact, and that would have been a good development.
Absolutely, it was an excellent development. When I say happy or not happy, right? You know, I think again, people have legitimate concerns about how the state is going about implementing, you know, its assessments, how local school districts are implementing the assessments. And so I think, you know, having achieved the first victory last March on the limits, right, the breadth, the scope of the state's authority and constraining it, I'm sure that there would have been additional pushback as time goes on how the state is interpreting, you know, what equivalence requires, how the state is going about conducting its assessments, how the state is making its determinations. There's no doubt that there would have been, you know, future pushback and, you know, potentially future litigation because, you know, I think we all know our yeshivas are rich, vibrant educational institutions, right? Our kids are there from morning till evening, you know, learning to love learning in the mornings, you know, in Limudei Kodesh, which, again, you know, state bureaucrats do not have an appreciation of what goes on during Limudei Kodesh. You know, they think it's, sometimes they think it's chanting. They think it's, you know, rote memorization. You know, we all know the depth and the breadth and the beauty of what goes on with the Kodesh, how it challenges kids intellectually, right? How it involves, you know, whether it's, you know, in Chumash Rashi, how it involves language skills in Mishnayos and obviously in Gemara. They don't appreciate that. And then you get into even Achol and, you know, they have all sorts of nitpicking. You know, it's not enough if you read. We want to know what the range of text you use. So there's a lot of problems with the state's assessments of how they go about it, with the assessments that the state makes of yeshivas, with the way the state, you know, determines what's equivalent or not. So there surely would have been, you know, further pushback and further tension points between it. But last year's victory was an important step to preserve the independence of parents to choose how to direct their child's chinuch and important step to protect Moist's ability to provide that service.
Understood. Okay, yeah, I appreciate it. No, you're clarifying a lot for me here, which I, you know, it's very hard to get just from reading the literature, so thank you for that, and that's why we have you on. And, yeah, the level of academia, of critical thinking, the, you know, intensity, healthy intensity of Limudei Kodesh in any typical yeshiva is just phenomenally, like you say, an outsider could never even begin to fathom it. So I don't even know how they would even go about, but it's so, so breathtaking to those of us who have been through it. It's rigorous, and at the same time, it's incredibly positive. It's an amazing act, and we could have an episode all day just talking about the Rebbeim and the yeshivas and all that they do. So I'm glad you're bringing that out. Let's talk about the appeal last week. You say it was disingenuous. What exactly was the state trying to argue, and what was disingenuous about it?
Well, so the state argues we're not closing the school. We're just telling you the students can't attend, and the, you know, services can't be provided there. You won't get a bus there. You won't.
Oh, come on!
Who need special services won't get it there. And as we said in our brief, the state seems confuse the building with what goes on in it, right? They're not putting on like a Department of Health closure, you cannot enter the building, but of course they're closing the schools. You can't have students, right, if it's not a school, right? You know, the provision that was struck by the court. One of the provisions that was struck by the court was a provision that said the school will no longer be considered a school, you know, for purposes of the education law. So, of course, they're closing the school. And, in fact, the first question that the state got, the state went first. It was their appeal. So when the party that files the appeal, you know, it files the papers first, and it gets up and argues first because it's, in a sense, it's their case, right? It's their challenge to the decision below. And the first question that was asked by the court of the state's lawyer was, come on, I'm paraphrasing here, but whatever words you use, surely you acknowledge that you're closing the school when you tell the parents that they have to, you know, enroll their children elsewhere. So, you know, thankfully that judge, you know, got it.
Yeah.
And I said there were five judges, so, you know, you need at least three to get a majority. But that's, you know, sort of the way in which it was argued by the state. They weren't trying to confront head on the merits of our argument, right? The limits of the education law. They were trying to dance around a little bit and play semantic games.
Wow. And another thing that they argued, from what I read, is that yeshivas don't have standing at this point to even file a lawsuit because, even though the law is on the books, it has not yet been enforced. Is that accurate?
Yeah, I mean, it's a little worse than that. Yes, they said, the court, you don't have to decide this now. It's too early to sue. It's too early to sue because while there have been determinations of non-equivalence, the way it works is before a school is closed, there's two rounds, right? They determine non-equivalence, and then they say, we'll come back again. And so you have to wait for that. But that's not the law, especially when you challenge a regulation, you do it in a proceeding that's called an Article 78, which just refers to the section of the rules in the state's, you know, rules, called CPLR. So it's called an Article 78 proceeding. You only have 4 months to bring an Article 78 proceeding. And so, of course, this is not the first time it's come up. Courts have been clear that the state can't try to insulate its regulations from attack by just, you know, devising them so that, you know, the bad consequence doesn't occur until after 4 months. And so, you know, to us, it's sort of another signal that the state is not comfortable defending the case on its merits, right? It doesn't say we have the right to close the school. It says the building could stay open. They could do other things there. They said in their brief, they could have a Sunday school, as if that's what parents want for chinuch. And so, you know, the next level of argument was, Your Honors, it's too early. There's no harm yet. And again, of course, the harm is just operating on the threat of closure, operating on the threat of penalties and fines and even parents, right? If very few parents are going to enroll their children in a school if they think there's a real chance that the school's not going to be around in 2 or 3 years, right? Parents are looking for stability. They want to send their children there from kindergarten through eighth grade and maybe beyond. And so again, it to us was a signal that they're not comfortable in the merits.
Fascinating. Yeah, they're grasping at straws. And like you say, it sounds like they realize that the moment you mention closing down a school or anything remotely like that, or you know, taking away funds, it sounds like they recognize that even possibly liberal judges are not going to side with them. So they're trying desperately to say that's not what we're doing, right? That's really your point.
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, it's, again, one of the judges asked the state's lawyer, well, you know, you say now it's too early, and you know, if the school comes back in a while when they finally get to the, you know, to the end of a long process with the state education department, you know, is the state going to say that now it's too late to sue?
Right.
And he hemmed and hawed. He didn't say, of course we wouldn't say that. He acknowledged
they
might, right? Which is, you know, it's the old joke about government lawyers. You know, they say no case is ever ripe. It's not yet. You can't sue until they can argue that it's too late to sue. and that also was very exposed during Thursday's argument.
Yeah, and you almost can't make this stuff up. Yeah, it just sounds bizarre. So you mentioned that one judge who was kind of questioning on those issues. I mean, any impression in general of the panel of what they were thinking? Did they give away any of?
It's hard to read. You never know. They ask questions of both sides. And, you know, listen, we have to acknowledge that, you know, in New York, generally the state has an upper hand, right? The government is often overly deferential to state agency action, and you know, we're not all that popular. But we got a fair hearing. You know, they heard both sides, and we'll have to wait for the decision. I think we're hopeful that anybody who looks, you know, at the merits carefully, you know, understands that we're correct.
And very interesting. Now, Jen, just so I understand how the process plays out, when do you expect a ruling from this panel? And then what would be the next step? Let's assume, let's try different options, but let's assume that they would uphold the Supreme Court ruling of last year, which is against the state. Would the state then be able to file another appeal?
Okay, so thank you for asking. There are three levels of courts, excuse me, in New York. The lower court, the trial court, is called State Supreme Court. That's where we were last year. Then the intermediate appellate court is called the Appellate Division. There are four different appellate divisions within the state. It's split up geographically. So we were at the Appellate Division in Albany. It's called the Third Department. And then from there, you can go to the Court of Appeals. That's the highest court in the state. They don't hear that many cases, you know, of all the cases that bubble up, but that's where you would go. And I guess my assumption was that if we prevail at the appellate division, then the state will try to continue to try to get relief, this time from the Court of Appeals.
Okay, so that would be still an option for them. I have to believe that they would pursue that. And in the other direction, if, let's say, they would strike down the Supreme Court ruling, So what would then be the next step, I guess, on our end, on your end?
It's likely that we would do the same, that we would seek, you know, we would seek to have, you know, the case heard by the Court of Appeals. Now, I should say, though, you know, as I said, they don't take that many cases. The one way for the Court of Appeals to automatically take the case is if the appellate division is split 3-2. Right? As I said, there was a panel of five judges. If it's a 3-2 decision, then automatically the case goes to the Court of Appeals. So that's one way in which the case could get there, and then it could be what they call an issue of statewide importance, a lot of conflict between the various appellate divisions on the same, you know, issue, constitutional questions. So there's a range of ways, and this surely might be the kind of case that the Court of Appeals hears. But, you know, right now we're focused on the appellate division and the five judges there who heard the case. And, you know, again, I think it you know, hopefully resonates with the court about, you know, the awesome power to close a school and operating under the threat of that power. And there's also just issues about that cut across lines. And I think it's important to note, while it's the Yeshiva case, it truly is, there were amicus briefs filed by groups that are not part of the Yeshiva community, including, you know, by the Council of Catholic School Superintendents. In other words, the entire Catholic school community filed a brief with the court explaining their agreement with us and, you know, their agreement with the decision below and asking the court to affirm it. There was another religious group up in upstate New York called the Bruderhof community. They joined a brief, you know, making the same arguments. The OU put in a brief as well as others. And so, you know, hopefully the court, that's what we're focused on now, that the court sees the breadth of that and, you know, the rights of parents. Again, just to add one little point to this, you know, when the court below, and we argue that, you know, parents, you know, have the right to direct the education of their children, and the compulsory education requirement is on parents, you know, the court said below, that's right, and, you know, if you combine sources, if the state thinks, if a local school district thinks that a school is missing, you know, some element, so the parent has the right to supplement. Right, you don't close the school and tell the parent they can't send there. The parent has a supplement, and the state says no. The state says the parent don't have the right to supplement. You can't provide education from a combination of sources. Now we pointed out in our briefs and in our argument, we pointed out that state law says explicitly, if you as a parent want your child to be an actor, and so you take your kid out of school for 6 months. And you put them on a set where they're, you know, whether it's on Broadway or a movie or television, who knows what, right? The kid's out of school. The law says you can combine sources. You can have a school for whatever months of the year, whatever subjects the kid learns in school, and a tutor separately for whatever the kid, you know, while the kid is on set. So the law explicitly says you can combine sources. Now, it cannot be right? That for child actors, a parent has the right to combine sources if they want their child to be an actor, but doesn't have the right to combine sources
wow.
if they want the child to be in yeshiva, right? And the state said, no, it's limited to actors.
Really? Wow, that's just absurd. That's just so weak. That reminds me of when the Trump lawyers, when they were arguing for Trump's immunity, and they said, you know, the judge basically said to them, well, are you saying that if the president shoots one of his opponents or guns down one of his opponents, that he's technically, and from what I understood, the Trump lawyers were a little bit, regardless of what you believe in the merits of that case overall, but that's quite weak to just limit it to actors. I mean, that's a brilliant, brilliant point on your end, that they are allowed to, you know, basically use multiple sources.
Yeah, well, listen, we take these cases seriously, and of course, you know, try to scour the law to, I mean, there are other aspects of the argument as well to prove the inconsistency in the state's argument, how they're using it against yeshivas and yeshiva parents. And so it was striking, and it's something, again, we pointed out at the argument, it was really striking to hear the government's presentation, because the one thing you didn't hear out of the lawyers for the state education department was anything about education, was anything about the children, right? It wasn't like they were expressing concern about what the kids learn or the need to for them to have more power so the kids could learn something different. It was all about control, right? We need the right to close the yeshivas. We want to have the ability to constrict the ways in which parents can comply with their obligation. And so it was striking. Honestly, it was distressing, right? Because you would hope that the education department is focused much less on its power and control and much more on just ensuring that the kids get the education. And once kids are educated, you know, at a yeshiva, at a combination of sources, right, everybody should be happy and move on and not try to just flex their muscle and make it about their ability to be in charge and to say exactly how it gets done. It's one thing to say kids have to have a basic education. It's another thing to say, and you have to do it exactly this way at this place, our way or the highway.
No, it's disgraceful. I know you're being more polished about it, but it's just disgraceful. Like you're saying, it's all supposed to be about education. Education doesn't even get mentioned. And in light and in the context of all the other things that we're seeing, all the anti-Semitism out there that's being exposed, including amongst people who are supposed to be our friends, you know, it all jives very well. You know, the agenda here about targeting yeshivas, targeting from community. At least that's, you know, what I'm going to say. Now, I am curious, in light of that, really, is there any concern? You know, there's the legal aspect and then there's the political aspect, or it's not even politics necessarily, but it's the emotional side or the agenda side. Meaning, are you confident that the judges are looking at this purely from the lens, because they're going to have a personal opinion? It's inhuman not to. If I was sitting there, I would admit that I don't have objectivity on the other side. So are you confident that this is going to be looked at? Because legally speaking, everything you're describing, this is a no-brainer. But does sometimes the agenda slip in?
I'm certainly not going to impute any improper agenda to the judges of the appellate division. I mean, I think everybody has their own natural biases toward government or against government, right? You know, for more freedom for parents or less. And everybody comes with their own preconceived notions. But, you know, we filed our briefs. The court accepted the amicus briefs from the various parties who were supporting the yeshivas, right? The state wasn't so happy with that. And they accepted those briefs. And we had our arguments and got fair, respectful questions all around. And so now, you know, we work within the system, and we wait for a decision.
Is it? It's by the way, it's pronounced amicus. I haven't brushed up on my Latin lately. A lot of the media pronounces it amicus brief.
Amicus. As long as they read it, you
potato.
Know, as long as you spell it right, and they read it. We're not gonna, you know, Brooklyn tomato tomato. I guess.
Yeah. And right, New Yorkers, we have to be different. Got to pronounce it amicus. Any chance, just from a process standpoint, is there a chance that this goes to the federal Supreme Court?
Not this precise case. Whether the issue could go there at some day, you know, depending on, you know, the kind of challenge that's constructed and the kind of action that, you know, in an as applied case, right? If the state, you know, says, listen, the Kodesh doesn't count, right? You know, for this or that or the other thing, right? Or some things like that. It's certainly possible if the state, you know, acts arrogantly and acts in a way that's disrespectful of and dismissive of religion. It's always possible. I mean, that's a long path, and you just have to be wise about, you know, the cases you bring and the consequences, you know, along the way. You know, people are used to, you know, in during the pandemic, when then Governor Cuomo tried to impose different and more restrictive rules for shuls in Brooklyn and South Brooklyn, right? We went to court and we got to the Supreme Court and we got there fairly quickly on an injunction. But that's prevailed. We got the injunction. He announced his rules October 6th and we got the injunction just about midnight on November 24th. But that happens, you know, once in a lifetime to have it happen that quickly and that positively. So this is a long-term, you know, game and process, and we have every move you have to really think about what the consequences are and the unintended consequences are. And for now, you know, the yeshiva community are united in terms of sticking to our principles. And we hope with that and Siyata Dishmaya, we will continue to get the protections from HaKadosh Baruch Hu and continue to provide the chinuch that they've been doing for, more than 100 years in New York and many, many years before that across the world.
Yeah, amen. And the unity is incredible across the spectrum and yeshivas and institutions that maybe are not unified in a lot of other areas, which is fine in a respectful way, but incredible, incredible amount of achdus. And what I appreciate about you, number one, obviously, you know, your passion and the devotion, you know, I mean, this is personal for you, obviously, but you know, you give everything to it. In addition to your knowledge and the fact that when we have you on here and we have these conversations, you break it down in the way, you know, your clarity of this case, which is obviously, hopefully, Mirta Shem, why you do such a good job of representing us and arguing for us, but also your ability to break it down. And without getting too far into the weeds, I appreciate that to, you know, more than I could describe. And don't think that goes unnoticed. So you're really amazing. Any other final thoughts?
Sure. Just one. Thank you. First of all, thank you for those kind words. Just one final thought. And you asked about sort of politics generally. I will say this, right? Our yeshivas are not as well understood as they should be and as we think they are. I think, you know, and part of the issue here is when, certainly early on, right, when people start, you know, spreading rumors about yeshivas and complaining and talking about it, we know how ridiculous that is because we know what kind of rich, challenging learning environments our yeshivas are, and we know how favorably they compare to what goes on elsewhere in the broader world. But the world doesn't know that, and I think, and you know, sometimes we don't, you know, we don't want outsiders, you know, if we don't have to. And so, you know, I think it'd be really important for every yeshiva to work with their lay leadership, work their community leaders, bring outsiders in. It's a controlled environment. Bring your city councilman, bring your local elected official, bring your assemblyman, bring your state senator. The more you bring them in, the more impressed they're going to be, the more they're going to know what a yeshiva is. So when they hear something about a yeshiva, they're not getting their impression from something in the New York Times. They're getting it from their own eyes and ears sitting in front of school. It's something we don't do enough of, and it hurts us. And I understand the natural instinct, but especially in these times we're under attack. If you bring an elected official into yeshiva and they see how respectful the kids are, how passionate the rebbeim and the teachers are, you know, how lively the halls are with whatever is being hung, whatever projects the kids do, you know, and how the kids are able to interact with their, whether it's rebbeim and with the kodesh or their teachers during the secular studies portion of the day, how they can interact with whoever's visiting, all that will really, really serve us well in years to come when our enemies, you know, if our enemies are arguing against a blank slate, people, you know, believe it. They don't know anything different. When they've seen it, when they've heard it, when they've experienced it, our enemies won't have the same ability to spread lies about us. And so, you know, each yeshiva is busy. They have their own things going on every day. They're struggling to make payroll and just to keep going. I appreciate and know that. But one of the best long-term things we can do, bring people in, let them see it, let them experience it, and it will pay dividends for many years to come.
Excellent, excellent point. I hadn't thought of that. And I'll add, I meant to mention this earlier. This is obviously a time of tefillah. It always is, but a time to daven, and especially now as this decision is, as we await this decision over the coming weeks. So certainly a very, very crucial time.
Let's hope... We continue to get the the protections of a Kodesh Baruch.
Amen. Okay, wonderful and very, very special Yid. Avi Shick, we cannot ask for a better representative and spokesman for our community. Avi Shick on the VIN News Podcast.